Okay, past John and Garrett here, and we are about ready to randomly generate our topic. Usually I have a list of things and then roll a dice or something like that, but because I'm with Garrett of Liminal Earth, I thought they could use the Liminal Earth map as a jumping off point. So Garrett's going to randomly generate using the random story function on the map and then read whatever pops up.
Can you add a drum roll right here while I do this? All right, random story. Oh, this is a good one. It's actually not much of a story, but it's a place that's interesting. It's the Mima Mounds. It says, south of Olympia, Washington, hundreds and hundreds of mysterious earthen mounds cover the landscape. Stretching as far as the eye can see, these unusual geological formations have never been explained to the satisfaction of most who encounter them. Excavations into the mounds suggest that they are not burial mounds or even man-made. The mainstream party line, in quotations, claims that they were either carved by glaciers or maybe even created by gophers. This mysterious landscape is well worth a visit if you're traveling through Washington. Yeah, have you ever been there to the Mima Mounds?
I haven't, but me and Omli are going to go now so that I can really get into the vibe for this one.
I went recently. I was going down to the Chehalis Flying Saucer Party, and I stopped there, and they're amazing. They're these just weird hills. I don't know. You have to look at a picture or go visit. They're amazing.
That's awesome. Well, that's our jumping off point. That's really cool. A place.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to dig in and see what happens.
So, okay. Well, that's going to be really fun. Cue the theme music. Welcome to Randomly Generated Rabbit Holes, a side series by Anomalous Waves. I'm John, your host and sound guy, and today my guest is strange pal Garrett Kelly, co-founder of Hollow Earth Radio, amateur ham radio operator, and part of Liminal Earth, a map of the strange, unusual, and unexpected. I've talked about Liminal Earth many times on Anomalous Waves, so I'm going to assume you already know about it. But if you don't, you can find the map at liminal.earth. May I suggest that you start by using the random story function? This is the random way Garrett and I found our topic today, and the way that Amelie and I like to end a lot of episodes lately, and something we'll continue to do. Like most episodes of Randomly Generated Rabbit Holes, the Mima Mounds were merely a starting point for us. And we got led elsewhere rather quickly. So before we start, and since you're about to hear an hour plus of Garrett and I, let's get into some background and legends about the Mima Mounds with Amelia. But before we do that, it's important to note that this is a mystery to scientists, but there are stories from several tribes explaining the creation of these mounds. And like Garrett says here.
Yeah, I think it's the Squally tribe, Squaxin Island, and Chehalis all have some stories about how it came to be. Or this idea that like it's a mystery to everyone is not really true, because some people, they know exactly how it formed. So I think that is important to mention.
Also, it is pronounced Mima Mounds. You'll hear Garrett and I use Mima and Mima, but according to this newscast...
Is it Mima or Mima?
Mima.
But your name is Mima.
We call them Mima Mounds because it's referencing the Mima Prairie.
All right, now over to Amelia.
The Mima Mounds are located in the Mima Mounds National Area Preserve in Olympia, Washington. In 1841, Captain Charles Wilkes, an explorer in the Northwest, came across them and at first thought they may have been burial mounds. He ordered his crew to dig inside of them, and all that they found was river rock. I wanted to learn more about Captain Charles Wilkes, so I looked into him, and I learned he was a terrible, terrible man. He was really harsh to his crews, and he even illegally punished them. And when he returned from his expedition in Washington, he was actually court-martialed for his actions, but unfortunately, he got away with all of it. Now, Wilkes may have also been the inspiration for the character of Captain Ahab in the novel Moby Dick. Now, I found three theories of the Mima Mounds that I found interesting, and the first one is that the Mima Mounds were formed after Ice Age glaciers began receding almost 17,000 years ago. As the ice melted, it gathered massive loads of gravel and rock, and that accumulation of melted ice and stone spread over western Washington, and it created the unusual black gravelly soil that eventually formed the mounds. Theory two is that due to the rich prairie soil, scientists often wonder if burrowing pocket gophers created the mounds, but there is some speculation if these little creatures could create mounds that are over 8 feet tall and 30 feet wide. And the third theory is that the mounds are from intense ground shaking from earthquakes. The area where the Washington Mima Mounds are found experienced a major earthquake about 1,000 years ago. The Upper Chehalis people actually have a story that tells how these mounds were formed. What I'm about to read is a version of their story that was printed in a Chehalis tribal newsletter in 2010. A long time ago, the animals and birds lived as people. Thrush wanted to marry a certain young girl, but her parents did not approve of him. But the young girl, however, wished to marry him. The girl persisted, and finally her parents gave their consent. Thrush and the young girl were married. Thrush always had a dirty face. He never washed before he ate. His mother-in-law asked him, "Why don't you wash your face?" Thrush did not answer. The next morning she asked again, "Why don't you wash your face? It's getting dirty." Thrush again did not reply. She asked him the same question for 5 days in a row. Finally, on the fifth day, Thrush said, "If I wash my face, something will happen." Nevertheless, his wife's parents still insisted. Then they gave him an ultimatum. "If you don't wash your face, we'll take our daughter away from you." So Thrush finally gave in. "All right then, I'll wash my face." He went to the river to wash his face and sang, "Father-in-law, mother-in-law, keep moving back from the river." He washed his face and the dirt rolled off, leaving his face streaked all over. Then it began to rain. It rained all day. Thrush told his in-laws, "Move back from the river. I wash my face as you asked." The river continued to rise, and it rained many days and nights. Soon there were no places for the people to stand in but in the water. The water rose and covered everything. There was no place for them to go. Many drifted away and were never seen again. Thrush, his wife, and his in-laws landed their canoe on this side of the land in Upper Chehalis country. There was only the top of one tall fir tree sticking out of the water, and that is where the people tied their canoe. They got together and planned what they should do next. They agreed that someone needed to dive in the water and see how deep it was. Muskrat dove into the water and came up with some dirt. He dove down into the water 5 times. Each time he brought up some dirt, and from the dirt, he made a little mountain. He told the people to land there, that they would be safe. He told the people, "This is the mountain that I have made for you, so that you can be safe." The people called that mountain Tiger Lily Mountain. It is known today as Black Mountain. After the water receded and the earth dried up, the earth was found to be covered with dried whales. At Gate, not far from Mima Prairie, the earth still remains. It is in the shape of waves. It extends like this for 4 or 5 miles. After the water subsided, the earth was just like new, and the people began all over again. It was said, "There shall never again be a person who will cause a flood when he washes his face." Thrush turned into a bird and flew away.
right outside of Olympia. There's a bunch of, I think it said 22 miles of these. I'm not sure if that's true, but it's just endless. These weird mounds. They're a total mystery how they got here. It's very quiet here and rural. There's a lot of theories about what it could be. It could be glacier deposits, earthquakes, giant serpent, gophers is the big one. Yeah, this is just a weird area too. Like, not too far away is where Kenneth Arnold saw like the first, what he called, flying saucers. A lot of UFO stuff and just a strange area of Washington. And we're gonna go to a little town, I think about 20 minutes away from here, called Oakville. So in Oakville, there was this report of this rain of this like jelly, which they call the Oakville blobs. And it rained more than once. Like, I think it was like 4 or 5 times over a span of time. And people who went untouched it got sick, actually. So some people were sick for a couple months even. And this is like in the 90s it happened. There's a New York Times article. There's an Unsolved Mysteries episode about it. Just a weird thing that they never really figured out. There's some reports that it had human white blood cells in it. Some other stories about how it had like 2 forms of bacteria, or it was living, all kinds of interesting stuff.
That was perfect, like, excuse to head to some random little town.
Right.
And like you said, August 7th, 1994, I think is when, like, the first Oakville blob sighting possibly was.
Right.
Because one of the old newspaper clippings I got is from August 24th, 1994. And it mentions a strange gelatinous goo raining twice in the past 2 weeks. It had to have been sometime in mid-August. And this is probably before the other incidents happened as well.
It's weird to be raining in August. I guess that technically it could happen, but...
That's another good point, especially around... Washington area, like,
yeah, it's not like we have like the Florida rain in the summer kind of vibes, you know. We just get, I guess it can happen.
It does seem to dry up for months though, once it does,
right? It's like we get 2 months of like summer and then, so I don't know the weird microclimate though in Oakville, so maybe it's a little different in that spot. But yeah, apparently there's this in the 90s. It was raining, and I think a police officer is one of the first people who had this stuff landing on his windshield that when the windshield wipers were going, it like smeared into this strange like petroleum jelly is how he described it. And he got out and put gloves on and touched it, and it was this weird blob stuff. And other people in the town also found it in their yards, and... some people got sick afterwards after touching it. Yeah, it's just this mystery that they haven't really been able to explain. In fact, it was on Unsolved Mysteries. There's a great, you can go find it on YouTube. You can find the little episode of the people that were kind of affected by it are talking about what happened there.
Yeah, I will link to that episode. I think the original one aired in the early Robert Stack style mystery, mm-hmm. and then they kind of recycled it and used it again. But the officer's name is David Lacey. In the episode, he was on patrol with a civilian friend at 3 a.m., which is kind of interesting detail.
Yeah.
And he says, like you said, Garrett, we turned our windshield wipers on and it just started smearing to the point where we could almost not see. We both looked at each other and we said, geez, this isn't right. I mean, we're out in the middle of nowhere, basically. And where did this come from? So then they pulled over. He knew to get latex gloves is what he says. And he described the substance as mushy and almost like if you had Jell-O in your hand and you could pretty much squish it through your fingers.
That's
very, very good detail. Specifically, I now know that Officer David Lacey at one point did indeed squeeze Jell-O through his fingers.
Yeah.
And then he says, we had some bells go off in our heads that basically said that this isn't right. This isn't normal.
Yeah.
So that was the officer's point of view. And like you said, there was individuals who got sick. On August 7th, they described it as causing dizziness, nausea. And it was reported that a newly adopted kitten that lived outside got sick and died several days later from intestinal problems. Mm-hmm. So it does seem that this rain goo had something going on.
Right.
But the second one, no one got sick, according to this newspaper article from the Island Packet. During the second rain, nobody in that household got sick, which I believe is referring to Sunny Barcliffe and her mom.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're the ones that first reported getting sick.
Yeah.
Is that how you remember it? Yeah.
Yes. Uh-huh. And they're the main people in the Unsolved Mysteries episode. And I did actually find Sunny Barcliffe on Instagram and eventually Facebook, and she got back to me. And I had found old, Goodreads posts and other, forum posts from Sunny. Or someone pretending to be Sunny. I'm not sure if it was her, wanting to have people help her write a book about this and what happened and the truth about what happened. And I actually wrote to her and she wrote back to me, but at this point, she does not seem interested in talking about it anymore. And I'm not sure why. I didn't press too much about it. I told her that, I'd be available if she wanted to talk. But it sounds like she's kind of over it. And I'm not sure why. Yeah, maybe it's just that thing that happens when people have something like this happen to them and a lot of people think it's a joke or whatever or kind of treat you funny because of it.
Yep.
But for whatever reason, that's conjecture, but, whatever reason, she doesn't want to talk about it anymore. So
I think that's a good point too, Garrett, is a lot of witnesses. And I've heard a lot of people say normalize the paranormal for these reasons. A lot of witnesses have a strange experience. And then if it does become viral in some way, which back then, lots of newspaper coverage and unsolved mysteries, everyone in the town might start treating you different.
Yeah.
We even met some people, I would say, in Oakville that just kind of called the officer crazy.
Right.
Pretty much said that they didn't believe them.
Yeah, we went to Oakville and we actually met locals there who were there at the time when it happened. And like you said, one person was saying, she's like, I think it's all BS. I was a kid. She was a teenager, young teenager when it happened. She's like, it wasn't a big deal. I went to school. I'd heard about it. I don't think she even saw any of this blob stuff, or she doesn't remember having seen it. And it wasn't. To her, it was like an isolated group of people who were experiencing this, from what my understanding of what she was saying. There was another gentleman there who said he saw it, but he also said it was blue in color, which is, everyone else describes it as clear. And one of the tidbits of information about, one of the theories is that it could have been sewage from a plane that's being released in the sky.
Yep.
But they say, oh, it couldn't be that because it would have been blue, and because that's how they stain that in airplanes. And it was clear, so it couldn't have been that. And then this person that says he experienced it said it was blue, which may be him just misremembering it or changing it to fit the narrative now or something. He was an older person, so I'm not sure. That was kind of a weird detail.
That was because, in my mind going into it before he said it was blue, was I'm like, well, the newspaper reported it as not blue. And specifically, so Dr. David Little in this newspaper said he thinks that Hearn's illness was an inner ear problem and not related to the blobs. But the lab that put the blobs under a microscope did indeed find human white blood cells, which is what made them think maybe it was waste from an airplane because it had human blood cells, but it wasn't dyed blue.
Right.
So it is interesting that he specifically mentioned that it was blue. Because it was like, you're the only one that has said that, though. So I do have to go back the other way. Another interesting thing that I found in this newspaper article was, it says that there have been no other confirmed reports of mysterious blobs, officials with several agencies said. But a National Weather Service employee in the area received a call from an unidentified man in early August describing hot metallic particles from the sky that burned holes in his children's trampoline.
Whoa, wait, when was this? When did this happen?
That supposedly happened in early August.
Wow.
So around the same time as the gelatinous goo.
That is wild.
Yes. It does ring some Maury Island bells a little
bit. Right, the slag.
The slag, yeah.
Even like the Maury Island incident that happened right before Kenneth Arnold saw the UFOs, that story has stuff falling out of the sky, right, too? Like weird flaming stuff, though, right?
Yeah, there was also, it didn't register until just now, but I also found something about, I think in the same area, someone reported small metal, hot metal.
Really?
Yeah, coming out of the sky or something, like landed on their roof, like hot chunks of metal, which that sounds kind of similar to the Maury Island incident, okay. But that was kind of described as like almost like newspapers crumbling out at first.
Uh-huh.
But then when it landed on the boat, it was like little rock metal
shards or whatever.
Yeah. I could be wrong of the exact definition of it, but I know they were hot.
Yeah.
There was another thing I saw. I listened to a podcast about the Oakville blobs. I can't remember which one it is now. And they mentioned this, but it was also in the Wikipedia, I think, if you look up the Oakville blobs. But
mm-hmm.
There was a similar thing falling out of the sky in Everett, which is about, like an hour north of Washington. They also had something like this happen there, but I cannot find a newspaper article reference or source for it. So I don't know what that was just another one, and it gets referenced as well. So
I saw the reference to that as well, and just like you, could not find any evidence to back it up.
Right.
But saw that see, this becomes a thing. I've talked about this with Amalia before too, is you start to find that sources are just quoting other sources with no like original source.
Yeah, it's like ChatGPT. It's just like re-referencing.
Yeah, exactly. They're just it's re-referencing and kind of rewording in different ways. And every once in a while, you'll find a little blip of something else. And you're like, oh, wait, where did this come from? Because this wasn't in the other right. four things. And then you get obsessed with that detail.
Right.
Also, I mean, it was taken seriously enough to, you know, get quotes from, at the time, the FAA spokesman in Seattle. His name is Dick Mayer.
Mm-hmm.
He said, we don't know what it was or where it came from. It's a puzzle. You know, so they specifically said they didn't know where it came from. And then some people were throwing out theories like the jellyfish theory.
Right. Uh-huh.
Which was very interesting. The idea is that there was like military testing of dropping bombs, which they were doing about 10 to 20 miles west of Ocean Shores, Washington. But despite the 40 to 50 miles separating the bombing runs and the blob fallout, Oakville Chief of Police Gary Grube said somebody suggested a school of jellyfish might have been blown literally sky high. So that's what the paper says.
Yeah.
Many people thought that that's doesn't track too much, doesn't carry too much weight.
Right. And it didn't, I think people said it didn't smell like it was like fishy kind of anything like that, that it was some kind of animal remains. There wasn't that. So I think a lot of people don't think that that is a valid.
Also, since it happened multiple times.
Yeah. A lot of jellyfish blown up. Yeah.
So yeah, the Oakville blobs, that was really fascinating. Did you find any other strange things with it?
I was going to say that the people that we talked to there also were really seemed to be pointing to military stuff. And they talked a lot about the planes that fly over there and there being the Air Force Base or what Fort Lewis, I think, is nearby. So they just talked a lot about how, like, there's a lot of that in the air there and a lot of flight traffic in that way. So they have seemed to a lot of locals there, or the ones that we talked to, were really thought there was a connection between it. And we even saw like weird conspiracy stuff on the like built the community board about like weather wars and all kinds of things, which usually, you know, I dismiss that kind of stuff. But it's interesting that it happened. There's like this vibe there because these people in this town have had this thing happen there and that's unexplained. So it's just interesting relation, I think. There's people like talking about the weird stuff in the sky.
Yeah.
I did find that one other article, though, I think that's interesting. So I was searching like old newspaper articles, and I found, I wrote Oakville Strange.
It says, Oakville has strange storm. April 29th, following the thunderstorm Sunday afternoon, quite a sprinkling of a powder-like substance was noticed on the pavements in Oakville. When a match was touched to the particles of the substance, it is reported to have sizzled like powder. And what's interesting is that happened in 1921 in Oakville, which is, I think I've never heard anyone talk about this.
No.
So to me, like, there was all these stories that it was like airplanes dropping, like, also like another theory is airplanes dropping like sewage or like some government experiment, all kinds of like more modern theories. But to me, this is really weird that there was kind of like this isolated case where this happened in the 20s too. Not maybe exact same thing, but something weird falling out of the sky. This like sulfurous powder in this small, like tiny rural town we're gonna go visit. So I think that's super weird. I've been like chomping at the bit to tell you about this because I cannot believe that there's more than one instance of this.
That's amazing. And the reveal of this was 1921.
I know.
I love that. I
know. Isn't that crazy?
That is really crazy.
Like, I was just like, oh, I'm going to search strange Oakville and like start from the beginning, like the oldest, you know, and there it is, like a totally different case, you know, just like a little blip. There's two of them and they're from like the Tacoma News Tribune and like the Kennewick something. I don't know.
Wow.
Yeah, so like this was a thing that happened. I don't know if it's the same exact thing, but it's, you know, how often does like a weird thing drop out of the sky, especially in this tiny town?
So some other weird rain happened in Oakville. And this time it was more like powder-like. And actually, I think in that podcast, someone described the 90s one as powder as well when it dried up. I couldn't find that source either, but from the Courier Herald in Kennewick, Washington, they said it was a sprinkling of powder-like substance closely resembling sulfur. And they said that it would burn, you know, kind of like crackle. That is weird because it happened in 1921. There wasn't like military planes doing this, you know, or even like, you know, waste from a commercial plane. So something weird has fallen out of the sky in this Oakville. And when we went to Oakville, it is small town.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there was, like, the only thing open was, like, that place that makes, like, sheep blankets or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And, like, the burger joint we went to.
Yeah.
Where we talked to the locals, and they actually have a burger that has goop on it.
Yeah, and I did find out that that's, like, a traditional Northwest, like, fries, not quite fry sauce, but, like, a tartar relish sauce kind of thing.
Oh, okay.
And it's called goop.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, it was so funny that we were talking about blob burgers, because we were like, you know, if you if you could, like, sell the vibe and right. make like a little diner, and then you found burgers with goop, which was hilarious. And I thought it was peanut butter because there's a burger called a Goober Burger that has peanut butter.
I was like,
is that peanut butter maybe? But I guess it's a Northwest sauce. And but to your point, I'm so curious if the goo dries to powder.
Yeah. And I'm wondering if there's like some natural explanation for this. Is there some kind of something like a mushroom spores or some natural thing, or I don't know, that is like releasing this, that's causing this. I don't know. It's really weird. It's very strange.
Is there a cycle of some sort?
Yeah,
because
yeah.
That's in the 20s and then the other's in the 90s. So 70 years from then. So 2060, we got to check back in. Totally.
If you're in the future listening to this podcast in 2060, I wish, you know, find me in my retirement home and bring, come tell me what you've discovered.
Bring me a blob burger with you and totally. All the info you got. I'll also say in the paper, it talked about Sonny Barcliffe got the Department of Ecology to look at the goop. But according to Unsolved Mysteries, there's no records of the tests, which is also suspicious. And earlier you were talking about the conspiracy theory and us seeing a pamphlet and stuff. In this situation, I feel like it's a little different because it's kind of reactionary.
Yeah.
Like the conspiracy theory didn't come from like a place of like hate or like that kind of thing. It came from a like concern of military testing.
Right. I think the only other thing I would say is that we pulled cards. We pulled like the tarot cards, and I got that plane card, like plane, like a prairie kind of plane. Mm-hmm. And that one has been sticking in my head.
So this is, we're doing a two spread for current situation and then the thing that is in conflict. Plane. This is a good reading. Whatever Anthor is in it is a good reading. He's kind of like the deer spirit. And kind of like about withstanding in the face of adversity, kind of. The plane is interesting to me. Here's my read on it. I don't have it in front of me, but I think the plane represents like, if you look at a plane, it looks very plain. It looks like there's not. Anything to see there is just kind of like endless nothingness. But if you get close, you see like the details of an individual piece of grain or whatever is in the plane. Makes me think of the camas that we saw, which is the plant that's all over the Mima Mounds, which is this, I think that they grow in the plains of this area.
In its shadow version.
Oh yeah, it has a shadow version too, which is poisonous. So you have to know which one is which. Which is interesting, yeah. It's like you have to be able to tell discernment between the differences.
Mm-hmm.
I think this also is like these small towns are like, you may overlook them as being kind of the same or generic. But then every small town, I think, is unique and has interesting qualities to it. Like a town like Oakville has these blobs that fell out of the sky. And if you didn't know this, or you just come through here and think it's just a plane, but there's something pretty weird here that happened in the 90s and in 1921. So I think that's interesting.
You know, if I would have driven through that town, I would have, and not known the story, you would just never know. That like this thing had happened there, and you would never guess something like that had happened there. And to me, thinking about it, like, I mean, that card is about like, you look at a plane and it just kind of looks like, you know, boring, endless wheat field or whatever that doesn't have any distinguishing, features. But if you get down to a single piece of grain and you look at it, you see all the little details, and it's interesting at close range. And so, like, going to that small town and, like, actually seeing it for what it is and, like, investigating, like, its history and what happened there. We also found, like, The bank.
So here's the bank. This bank is the last bank that was robbed by horseback in the state of Washington.
Wow.
And there's a big celebration about it here. Not big celebration here about the robbery.
That's amazing.
I remember reading that in the, I was digging around.
You know, if you can dig into your small little town, I mean, this is a core thing about Liminal Earth, you know, your town probably has weird stuff about it in its history, and it's really, you should dig into it, I think. So I think it was just a good lesson. Like, this town, if I had no idea, I'd never heard of the Oakville Blobs, I would drive through there and no clue that it had this amazing story linked to it. So, yeah.
Let's talk WUFO a little bit. Something that I love and I know a lot of people love. And where did it start and where is it at these days?
Well, it started maybe a year and a half ago. Our friend Madeline Kelly, they were reading The Mothman Prophecies by John Keel. And there's a part that they found in there that said, the best time to see a UFO is Wednesday night at 10 p.m., like statistically at the time when this was written. And they posted that on Twitter. I think it was me said, like, oh, well, let's try this. You know, like, this Wednesday, let's go. I'll go outside and see if, like, we spot something. So a bunch of us, like, all just got ready. We went outside and we, like, decided to look up at 10 p.m., and for me, I know it was like a huge, it was just such a nice thing to have to do because it's still during the pandemic, you know, the height of the pandemic and like, you know, like this kind of group thing that we could do without having to be next to each other and coughing on each other. It was also really nice to be outside and have some like quiet time and just kind of like dealing with the stars, you know, and like looking up. It's very peaceful time. And it was fun to like all be on like Twitter reporting what we're experiencing. And a lot of people were like, I hear something moving in the bushes, you know, and it's like just a raccoon or something. But like, we're all like freaking out about like hearing frogs or something, you know, and it was kind of a fun like freak out. And over time we were like trying different experiments. We started going live, having like a pre-show thing where we gather and trying to do experiments where we try to communicate with aerial entities in whatever kind of form. So that could be, you know, birds or, you know, alien craft. We were trying to do kinds of experiments that even the people watching could do with us. So it wasn't as much of we're performing a experiment for you. We were trying to make more things that were like everyone could do. And we were trying to make it free. There's no paywall to do this or participate. We wanted it to be open to everyone and not, except for, you know, jerks or whatever, you know, racists and stuff. But, you know, everyone can participate in this. You don't even have to watch our stream or anything. You could go use the WUFO tag and do your own thing, you know, as part of it and like make your own stream or, you know, have your own group parties or whatever. That's fine. It just like the idea of all of us looking up at the same time and like putting more eyes on the sky was kind of what we were all about. And I think to me, a lot of it, you know, I did see a like one thing that was like kind of, it was different than a shooting star. It was bigger and it was almost like a white flare. It was really wild. I don't know what that was. But I haven't seen any UFOs, but I have spent a lot more time because Madeline is an astrologer and a, you know, astronomer. Every week they put up like, you know, a different constellation or thing to look for in the sky. So that in and of itself is like a good reason to go outside and look and like pay attention and like learn about that stuff. And it's been, that part of it's been really great. So it's just a great, like, Go ahead.
Instagram, right? Stargazing yeah. side quest.
Right.
You can see Maidland has created a really like concise weekly thing. I think it might be on a pause right now. I don't know by right. the time this episode, but yeah. a lot of cool stuff to look back on even.
Right. And we were doing cool, I think they were cool experiments doing stuff with like ChatGPT and John, you came on.
I think they're cool too.
Yeah.
Yep.
We were trying to like use ChatGPT as like, first we were trying to make ChatGPT be kind of like the dungeon master between, or like a operator between us and the entities. We don't know what we're talking to exactly, but we set an intention to be talking to certain entities and let ChatGPT be kind of the relay between us and them. And basically we set it up so that we told ChatGPT, hey, you get to decide which one of us here is going to do some kind of divination method. And these are the tools that each of us have. Like Garrett can do bibliomancy with some books and dice, and Jeremy has tarot cards. And like, these are almost kind of our like D&D like weapons or whatever. And you, ChatGPT, you're the operator. So you pick which one of us should do something in response to a question we're asking. And then whatever result we'll give it back to you, and you will help us interpret what this entity is trying to communicate through that divination. And it was so fun. It was like to push all of the responsibility onto ChatGPT to be the kind of person leading.
Yeah, decision maker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it's outside of our hands. It's ChatGPT is in charge of that. And it's really good at like making connections that maybe we don't see. But then we were having weird like synchronicity experiences as we were doing this. And we developed that further to try to kind of mirror the Philip experiment.
Mm-hmm. And we did get to a point where we kind of went old school seance, where Garrett was like, let's just all be quiet and just ask it to knock. And I heard a knock in my closet, or,
yeah,
you know, sometimes when planes fly over, it moves. But we also heard a strange sound that the rest of us were like, what is this sound?
Yeah.
Garrett, you tracked it down and I cleaned it up a little bit. Here's that sound.
Yeah, so the Philip experiment was just this idea that these parapsychology folks, like, they basically invented a ghost with a fake backstory of this person named Philip that did not really exist. They like created a backstory for him, and then they tried to communicate with this thing that they had completely fabricated. But they used like seance and all these traditional like ghost spirit divination methods. So like, you know, they kind of sat at a table and they did kind of like a seance, and they started having real results, like what people who do seances like experience. And it started acting like Philip, like the Philip that they had made up. It would respond in that way.
Mm-hmm.
So it almost, you know, whether or not you believe any of this stuff, I just think it's interesting. Like, I am into this idea of people's imagination or their subconscious or
mm-hmm.
the group intuition and storytelling, all these kinds of ideas, and like how that can somehow manifest in our real world using like our shared minds, or, you know, I don't know how it works. I just think it's interesting to try to experiment in that realm. And that's what we were doing on WUFO. And it's super fun.
So fun.
And we asked it. I remember we asked it. We did the thing where we got the weird sound. We asked it to make a knock. And we also asked it, like, after we leave this session, can you, are there any symbols or things that we will can experience in real life to know that you are real or whatever? And it told us to look for a blue dog. And then I think AP went over to his sister's house, I think he said, and they had just got a new dog that they named Blue.
Yeah.
And it was like a rescue.
It was like a blue healer or something too, I think.
Yeah.
The type of dog.
Yeah. And it was just like,
that's
what?
Just, and AP was part of the seance. So, right. I mean, yeah. That adds extra stuff to it. So yeah, that That's truly fascinating. And I agree. And the most interesting part about the Philip experiment is that it didn't really work too well until they got into the seance vibe.
Right.
And kind of mimicked what they believe a seance to be. They started receiving the effects of what they believe a seance, you know, like the next step or the results of a seance, just like very traditional, or what started happening. The tables started moving and they started hearing knocking. And I totally think that's interesting because when we're all exploring these strange things together, and whether we fully believe in them or not, There's a part of us that are like, even if I don't believe it, like, even if it's not real, if I believe it, something will happen.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, that with like placebo trials, they've even found that if people know they're taking the placebo, it doesn't matter because they know placebos work. That's how many layers the power of belief can add to something.
Right. Placebo is a perfect example for this, what I'm interested in. Like, and I was on a different podcast with Jason Schenck, and he was talking about, yeah, this idea of like what is really happening doesn't matter as long as sometimes there's this effect, and the measuring the real effect of what happens in the end is what's interesting. You know, like, did you get a result in the end, and did you find meaning in that? Like, that's more important than whether or not it's quote unquote real.
100%.
Yeah.
The ripples, the results, yeah. the importance, the how it made you feel, that all those things are valid.
Right.
Not necessarily just nuts and bolts evidence.
Right.
You know, so.
That's just the approach I take for all of it. And I'm just really interested in like doing experiments and doing kind of group activities where, you know, we're trying to use like our intuition and imagination and see if we can produce those kinds of results. I just think it's fascinating. And not to discount that people aren't maybe having real experiences and, you know, or like some of the stuff is explainable some other way, or, you know, I don't want to like discount anyone else. That's what I'm interested in doing is trying more of this kind of thing.
And creating pareidolia machines, as I've heard you.
Yeah.
Explain right. It. And I love that explanation because I've always thought, even with the phenomena, you know, we're getting a little deep, but that's okay.
Sorry.
I'm just like, I can feel myself about to go on a tangent and I'm trying not to.
No, good. I want to hear it.
But you know, I've always been extremely interested in shapeshifter lore, where I read a story like a big black panther turns into a electric orb ball, you know, and They could hear the static clinging. All these kind of ideas of like energy shifting. And a lot of times when I think of pareidolia, I imagine, I could be wrong, but I imagine my biological senses trying to form a pattern, give something meaning or a pattern.
Right.
And I always imagine people that, when they get into this weird liminal space and they have an experience with some other intelligence, that sometimes their biology is trying to form a pattern to make sense of it. And sometimes they see something really crazy that could be almost a dream mixture of things that their brain's doing some pareidolia stuff and trying to create a pattern. And sometimes it can be really wild. And I have no idea if that's what's going on, but that's what I'm interested in.
But, like, I think, like, Jacques Vallée or whatever, you know, like, the book Dimensions, it's like the culture that you're in helps shape that. It turns it into the shape of your worldview gives it that form. Like, at a certain time, that would look like fairies or, like, angels. Or in our modern time, you might see aliens. And your cultural context is what gives it its shape. But like, what, I don't know what the underlying thing is that is it, you know, the noise that you are turning into a pattern that you can understand. I don't know what that underlying animating force is or whatever that you're experiencing, but it's weird that, yeah, like our minds find a pattern that kind of you understand through your own culture. I think that's super interesting. And yeah, I want to create
figure out if there's ways to induce that, I think. I don't know. I think that's really interesting.
Weird. I want to know if there's a relationship between, is there a relationship between the Mima Mounds here and what's happening in Oakville, or all this stuff? Like, what is the relationship between this place? This place seems really special and weird, and is there some kind of link to
Not
it all?
To mention, out of all liminal Earth random stories, when you and I are choosing our random topic, we end up on a Washington location that we both could get to.
Right, right.
Fairly easily.
Right, right, right.
That's pretty amazing.
There's so many stories we could have gone to.
Oh.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I've you know, been doing the random story thing for a while for fun, and I've never just popped up on a random Washington location.
Yeah.
So, I know there's a lot in there, but the probability still seems pretty small. Yeah. Amazing. You want to go explore this place?
Yeah, I want to go walk. We're going to go walk around and maybe try to talk to the mounds.
I'm into it.
I couldn't find too much stuff when I was digging into the mounds specifically. Although we went there and it was like, it's such a cool place if you can go visit. And we did do like a little spirit box session when we were there. Which I have the audio for.
Edit John here. Just a clarification. This is an edited compilation of Garrett and I's Estes Method session at the Mima Mounds. I will also assume folks know about the Estes Method, but if not, I will link an article from Week in Weird that has the origin of the Estes Method and explains all about it. Okay, roll that tape.
Whoa, that's a weird noise already.
Hearing weird things.
I heard like a lady like, bah, bah.
Come out.
Here it comes on Earth. But you have to guarantee. I'm trying to tell you something. Peter, get off of me. There's just a couple more. Don't fight.
It's cool.
A lot of them.
What does this place have to do with the Oakville blobs?
Listen to us first.
Excuse me.
It's time for us to realize any second. Look. Rainbow.
What were the blobs?
The body illustrates what's new.
Will the blobs return?
It's us. They're all... all around us, open and longing.
Water.
There's not much there. A man? This time, it's by the water. You can get that. A lady over help.
Keep hearing, do it for those who can't.
She has me over. Look locally. The hills are strong. Yeah.
Pouring.
Impossible. But first, I like... no offense. It's me. Look at us. Having a hard time with big radio.
And one thing that, you know, I just listened to it for the first time actually today, right before this. And two things that stuck out to me in that is there's a part about a woman being over it. And that reminds me of Sunny Barcliffe. And that, like, because she's over it, like, you need to take over for this. There's some, I can't remember exactly what was said, but something to that effect. And also, like, looking locally, I think, was another thing that came up. Which has to do with the plane thing, I think, too. And like, and then also, we both talk about the water, which we didn't do anything related to water. But there is the Black River there. So a different Black River than the one that I'm personally invested in. But there's a river right there, and the Capitol State Forest. So that, to me, I want to continue and go back and go check that out because it seems like something that came up in that session, and it's kind of this big empty forest that's right there that I want to go see what's going on in that spot.
Speaking of water, so when I was asking kind of ChatGPT about like legends around the mounds, it said one such story from the Squaxin Island tribe tells of a great flood that covered the land, and the mounds were formed from the dirt that was left behind after the waters receded.
Mm-hmm.
The story goes that the mounds were created by the powerful movements of a giant serpent that thrashed about beneath the surface of the earth. I will say I didn't find anything to corroborate this ChatGPT story specifically about Squaxin Island legends. But I did find, at that time, I saw a blog from phantomsandmonsters.com talking about a great serpent. So I was like, it was like the same day kind of thing that I found that out. So I had to look into it. It's from Trenton Evening Times in Trenton, New Jersey. This is March 18th, 1908. And it comes from the log of Admiral Farragut. Probably saying that way wrong. But this is from his log. And this is after he arrived from Port Antonio, Jamaica. And he told the story. We picked the sea serpent up, or rather, the monster picked us up late one night. I was on the bridge when one of the passengers, an elderly man, rushed up and excitedly called my attention to a phosphorescent light several miles astern. At first, I thought it was a new submarine boat. As it came nearer, we put the searchlight on it and could see that it was some strange sea monster. Seemed about 120 feet long and threshed its way through the rough sea at a fearful speed. All night long it followed the vessel, and during the time most of the passengers and crew remained on deck, the phosphorescent glow of the monster lighted up the sea with a radius of 50 feet. What a fearful speed, but I would assume that it might be faster, at least, than the speed of the ship. The fact that the sea was lit up to a radius of 50 feet indicates that the plankton was disturbed beyond the sea serpent by some means or possessed an extremely bright artificial light source. On the next morning, about breakfast time, the serpent swam within 30 feet of the starboard side. The creature resembled a huge boa constrictor, with the exception of its body was green. From its side streamed seaweed and other marine growth. The monster raised its head several feet above the water. It had huge eyes projecting from the top of its head and two green horns that projected upward nearly 5 feet. The horns resembled large antennae and moved about continually. Three times the serpent crossed our bows, and fearing to run it down, I signaled the engineer to reduce speed to 5 knots an hour. Some of the people on board thought the monster was hungry, and they threw several snacks of peanuts and a few bunches of bananas. When they arrived off Cape Hatteras later in the day, the monster circled around and swam south. And that was the Oakland, California Tribune, March 28th, 1908. But that's a really cool story.
Yeah, totally. Especially
the glowing.
That's part, yeah. I was like, what could be doing that?
But I love when those sinks happen.
Yeah.
And it happens with the map a lot, too.
Uh-huh.
It's when I'm like really into something, and then all of a sudden I get kind of plagued with things that remind me of it.
Yeah.
So I was learning, I was trying to find legends that support the idea of a giant serpent. I did indeed find really cool legends involving the flood. Was very interesting, and then I ran into a giant sea serpent monster right after. So
that's awesome. I did find a couple of news articles that are kind of just like random, but they happened to be, you know, when I was searching for MIMA and Oakville. I found these other things that were like on the same page because I had searched like Oakville mystery, and then it something about Oakville boring, but then a story that had the word mystery in it, or you know, that kind of thing. And I could read some of them. I think they're kind of funny.
Please, please do.
This one is from 1889. It says, the editor of the Walla Walla Journal and Watchman systemically ridicules the silly report about the alleged haunted house in this city and believes it to be the plain results of a sour or overloaded stomach. In his journal, he says, for 60 nights have we, in company with the Honorable H.H. Hungate, during a legislative session, occupied the very apartments and never saw as much as a shadow of a ghost. The only night we felt a little uncomfortable was when Mr. Hungate set up the oyster supper and our kind landlady treated her worthy guests to an extra mince pie filled with raisins and steeped in currant juice. That, no doubt, is the size of it, and people who in this enlightened age believe in ghosts and kindred trash are usually pretty light in the upper story, or else are in the habit of retiring with a full stomach. I was like, wow, this is really biting, right? 1889.
Just ripping into. I mean, didn't like Scrooge say the same thing? Like, he was like, you're nothing but like a piece of roast left over. They were really obsessed with the idea that like upset stomach would make you see phantoms.
Maybe we should do that as an experiment, like just like gorge ourselves and then like see if we see some ghosts.
gotta eat like junk food and then go to a cemetery. Totally. And just,
I'm pro this idea.
Yeah, I am too, actually. I think we have to in the name of science.
Get some goop burgers and just like look for ghosts. Okay, this is from 1928 and also in the Daily Olympian. It's kind of a quick one. War vet, sure, he is not a ghost. William Houghton of Vancouver, whose body was buried by relatives last June, arrived here today from Calgary. A body found at Seychelles was identified by a watch and chain, clothing, and teeth as being that of Houghton. Recently, Houghton applied at Calgary for medical examination as a war veteran, only to be informed that he was drowned and buried and therefore could not have a medical examination. He immediately left for Vancouver to prove that he was no ghost. So that was weird.
That is weird. Was he proving to someone or to himself?
I don't know. It says that he was trying to get a medical examination, and I think they said, sorry, you're dead. This one is from 1924 from the News Tribune in Tacoma, but I think it happened in Portland. It says, spirits refuse to pinch hit for the medium. Summoned to clear him of charge, they turned deaf ear to his pleadings. So in Portland on May 23rd, it says, the departed spirits of the Church of Bethsaida wouldn't be summoned under the shades of Blackstone last night. W.W. Aber, head of that ghostly church, today was facing what court attaches termed a tough time when he failed to produce the spirits as he had subpoenaed to his aid. Aber, who's a medium, is facing charges of accepting money for conducting seances, which implies, according to interpretation of city attorneys, that Aber's stuff is all Tommy rot. To prove the realities of the spirit world, Aber agreed to produce a spirit in the grand jury room last night. He hung curtains profusely and fastened the windows tight. From his hidden chamber, he moaned ghostly guttural groans. Some of Aber's followers attempted to produce the right atmosphere by holding hands. One held the hands of Deputy City Attorney Statler for 20 minutes. Finally, the groaning Aber groaned it couldn't be done. It's too hot for spirits to appear, he said. Everybody in the stuffy jury room agreed to the truth of the observation. The perspiring Aber came from the recesses of his hidden chamber and told Judge Rossman he would have to face the court today without the supporting testimony of his spirit world witnesses. Judge Rossman murmured something about Aber's ghost being in contempt of court and adjourned the unusual session. So it's just a wild story about this medium who had to prove that he had real spirits that were talking to him, and they didn't show up in court. So I just thought that was really weird and funny. Like, what what are they doing in court in the 20s? This is amazing.
Like, yeah, that they're even like, yeah, go ahead, prove it.
Yeah.
Prove it, man. Yeah. Oh, my God. So they're pretty much saying, like, you're not real and you're, like, a crook and you have to prove that you can actually do this.
And he went for it. It's amazing. It's, oh, man, sounds so fun.
Truly believed in his powers then. Either that or he had, like, a nice, like, hoaxy setup that they, and then they, like, got caught or something and didn't,
right.
didn't roll through. Thanks for sharing those, Garrett, because, I mean, that's kind of the whole point of this, the randomly generated rabbit holes is,
right.
you know, just go off in whatever weird direction. And I just love that, like, starting off the same and then just like, whoosh, where do we go?
I totally.
Yeah, that was so fun.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much, Garrett. Please come back on soon.
Please, it was so awesome. This is great.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Anomalous Waves. Thank you to Garrett Kelly. I had so much fun hanging out, exploring these locations together, and diving into these rabbit holes with you. Make sure and check out Liminal Earth's work at liminal.earth by going directly to the website or also their socials, same thing, at liminal.earth. Check the show notes for all them links and ways to support the show, including joining the Strange Pals Club. You can find more information at patreon.com/anomalouswaves or go to anomalouswaves.com for all them links. But the easiest way to support the show is by telling somebody. Tell a scientist doing analysis on a strange goo that rained from the sky.
Tell a man raging about how all ghost sightings are actually from an upset stomach.
Tell a... Or just tell anyone who likes anything strange. Okay, we're going to end this episode with an instrumental I made during All Music's Day. This is day number 2 of Liminal Earth's 13 Liminal Nights. This is a really fun way to extend Halloween out for us weirdos. And it just ended a few days before this recording. I had fun partaking in many of the nights. And I can't wait to do it again next year. So you can find a link to more information about that in the show notes as well. Okay, thanks again for listening. Bye.